This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1993, Entertainment Weekly posited an idea that would forever change the local music scene in Chapel Hill. The magazine asked, is Chapel Hill the new Seattle? Soon the place was crawling with record executives looking to land a deal with indie rock bands like Superchunk, Dylan Fence, and Polvo. But not every band in Chapel Hill was part of the indie scene. The Squirrel Nut Zippers were born in 93. Their sound was a far cry from the edgy alt-rock that put Chapel Hill on the map. In fact, it recast the music of a previous generation.
What's that you say? Oh man, no way.
Lay it down on it and everything will be all right.
Tom Maxwell was a founding member of the Squirrel Nut Zippers. He wrote that song, Put a Lid on It, and the band's biggest hit, Hell. Both of them are on the Zippers' platinum-selling CD, Hot. Today, Tom's a solo artist, a writer, and a father living in Pittsburgh, and my guest this hour on The State of Things. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Frank, it's always a pleasure to see your beard again. Mr. Beard.
Still attached to the very face it was born on.
Do you remember when you shaved it off?
I do.
This picture came up on Facebook.
It's some high school pictures. Yeah, you know, it was kind of a mottled gray. It was a little gray and not quite, and it just looked like I was recovering from something.
No, so,
and
it works.
I didn't like that. Now it's all gray, and it looks great, or white, or whatever it is. When it just turned white, it looks good.
Okay.
But let's talk about us.
Please.
You actually started out in Fort Lauderdale, born there.
I did.
6 years later, ended up in the mountains of North Carolina, Burnsville, North Carolina.
Burnsville, North Carolina.
Tell us about that.
No culture shock at all, really, no big deal.
We were
just from Fort Lauderdale right to Burnsville. It's just swinging from vine to vine.
Well,
nothing to see here, Frank. No outsider identity was formed. No xenophobic, ripples were made.
But now the mountains at that time, I mean, which kind of mountains? What was it like for you?
Okay, so my memories of Fort Lauderdale are, you know, the sawdust on the floor of the butcher shop and the guy in the white apron handing you a piece of salami, or the 7-Eleven on the corner, or my brother falling out of the ficus tree, or, I don't know. It's like hot asphalt, mm-hmm. St. Mark's Episcopal School. And then Burnsville was no traffic lights, 1,200 people. Old people coming into town wearing hats and gloves, cars stopping in the middle of the main street to talk to each other. Religious.
You listened to a lot of religious radio.
I listened to a lot of, the AM radio, and there'd be these AM preachers. And then we show up, and my dad is an eternal Boy Scout, and he also like read Ayn Rand, I think, probably. So he had this idea of, I don't know what sufficiency, I don't know what. And so he decided, I think probably correctly, that maybe Fort Lauderdale wasn't the place to raise three little boys. And we moved. We had a summer house in Burnsville. And so at the end of the summer, we would park the Korean War issue Jeep in the living room and close the door. It was like a one-room cabin thing. And then this is our home. And so we go to that.
But now, what brought them to Burnsville? Because did he work there then?
No. He's an industrial designer. I mean, my dad is the last surviving member of the team that designed the Whirlpool Miracle Kitchen that Nixon and Khrushchev debated in. And he tells me stories about how they faked the technology and stuff, and they hired like a magician to do the self-propelled vacuum cleaner or whatever they had because they couldn't do the technology at the time. And then Nixon's like, every American home has one of these miracle kitchens.
Yeah.
And so he wasn't working at home. He owned a business in Fort Lauderdale. He had worked for GM styling and stuff in the 50s and worked on the Tampa airport and stuff like that. Why they had a cabin, they must have known somebody. And then in Fort Lauderdale, you probably want to be somewhere else in August.
Yeah. Well, and then the folks in the mountains kind of figured you were wealthy folks, right?
Yes, because my parents bought a four-wheel drive Chevrolet Blazer, a new one, a 1972 Blazer. I don't know why I associate this, but people thought we were wealthy, and because we moved there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We didn't come from there. We actually chose to go,
right.
I think. And then
built your own cabin. Not a luxurious place, though.
No. And then, but people thought we owned Maxwell House Coffee. So I would get that question. Do you own Maxwell House Coffee?
Yeah.
And then I'd be walking on the mountain when I was like, I don't know, 10 or something. And then the Floridian tourists would come. They didn't recognize their own. And to them, it was still, everything was just sort of one extended episode of Green Acres or something, you know. And they were like, are these plants edible? And they would talk really loudly. Excuse me, little young man, I'm not deaf.
Yeah, right.
I can speak your language. And like, right. You know.
Well, did you feel like saying, I'm one of you, take me back?
Or, no, because they were so repellent.
Yeah.
You know, do you have radio here? You know, so I was neither fish nor fowl.
Well, I was going to ask you, because on the one hand, it sounds like the adjustment wasn't that easy for you in some ways, that
well,
this
no,
was
you know
not
why,
the same
Frank,
place.
Do you
but
know
on
why
the
I
hand, just started to embrace and defend the country folk from...
I need to say this, because right. When I was in the first grade, some kid called me Floridy Dude. And it's funny now, you know, but it really hurt when I was...
Floridy Dude?
Floridy Dude.
Yeah.
First grade, second grade, with Floridy Dude.
So you're... But
I'm
again,
still wearing that, okay? That is like... That's branded on my forehead.
Apparently
I'm
the
Floridy
genesis
dude.
Of hell. Hell actually sprang from that experience.
Hell did spring. Actually, it did from that... From the... You've heard the, like, the AM radio hyperventilating fundamentalist preaching stuff, which is actually really neat performance art. But when you're young and impressionable, and these people are so unambiguous about where you're going, you know, if you don't sort of comply, that stuff's scary because there's no one there to say, you know, don't worry. Right. But they fall a little bit out of the mainstream.
It got to you. I mean, you were a little scared.
You bet.
But also, you're listening to them, but you also had an affinity for that kind of jazz music that became – when did you develop that?
That came much later.
Yeah.
What happened when I was in the mountains is that there was a neighbor, and by neighbor it meant that this guy lived 2 miles away from us, and his name was Rice Fitzpatrick. Really nice guy, and he'd had this career, I don't know, as a chemist or something. But when he was in college in the 20s, he was in a jazz band. And one day, I guess I started learning saxophone when I was 11, and he was like, okay. My boy, you know, I played clarinet or something, he said. He had, like, banjos and stuff on his wall. It was really neat. And he gave me his fake book. And so this is the thing which the musicians use, and it has popular songs of the day and the lyric and the chord changes and stuff. Yeah. So you can sit in with anybody and play along. And he gave this thing to me, and there wasn't a song in there after 1949. And my parents were like, oh, this is a huge deal. This is a really big deal. You should take care of this. And I was like, absolutely. And I put it on a shelf. You know, 12 years went by.
So you didn't,
nothing.
When did you develop your affection for that?
I came home. I was a rock and roll drummer. I go to UNC to go to school. I play drums. My folks, God bless them, like gave me a drum kit or gave me pieces of a drum kit over, you know, birthdays and Christmases.
Right,
and then before I'm out of school, I'm playing rock and roll drums. And then one night I see this video of Cab Calloway singing Minnie the Moocher.
Yeah. And so Cab Calloway, the music of and Fats Waller was another.
Yeah, just you can go from one to the other.
Yeah.
Oh, if you listen to Cab Calloway, then you're going to listen to Duke Ellington, then you're going to listen to Fats Waller, and you're going to listen to Louis Armstrong and all of a sudden, and you know, I'd heard this stuff from Bugs Bunny cartoons or you know,
right,
it's always
right.
been around.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always been around.
Well, so let's take a listen. I want to listen to Beale Street Blues. This is Fats Waller's version of that.
And then why don't we just listen to that?
A little bit. Then we'll come back and talk
about it.
No, I
think 10 times in a row.
Okay.
Play that thing, Mr. Waller Lord.
A little bit of Fats Waller, Beale Street Blues. When you started to listen to the music, I guess you got into a little of the criticism as well. You started to study up about these guys and how they were received in their time. Fats Waller was somebody who was, I guess, after the fact, maybe people liked his music, but after the fact, people criticized him.
Well, he was jettisoned, you know, in the 50s. He was dead, too, so that probably made it easier.
Yeah.
But at the time, he was... I think he was in the 30s. I think he was the most popular artist on RCA. I mean, of anybody.
Right.
forget that he was like a black dude or whatever. There's like he was selling so many records. Mm. And well, what can I say? Like that track was – he was 22 when he recorded that on a pipe organ in a church in Camden, New Jersey that RCA had taken over, and they renovated this pipe organ. And he really thought of himself as an organist. So he made these jazz – pipe organ side. Somebody needs to write a book. Because his dad was a preacher and he would play along with his dad on the street corners. But of course, he was essentially disowned because he played jazz. So he's playing minor key blues on a pipe organ in a church. This is good stuff.
The devil's music.
Didn't sell at all. Totally tanked.
Well, what about, I'm going to take a break, in fact, and ask you that question afterward when we figure out how that came to influence the music of Squirrel Nut Zippers, why you thought it could be commercially successful again, and all of that.
Who thought that?
Oh, you didn't.
Are you kidding me?
Tom Maxwell, my guest on The State of Things. Stay with us from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, musician Tom Maxwell, perhaps best known for writing this song that became a hit for the Squirrel Nut Zippers in 1996.
In the afterlife, you could be headed for the serious strife. Now you make the scene all day, but tomorrow they'll be held to pay. Attentively, I mean about future calamity. I used to think the idea was obsolete until I heard the old man stamping his feet.
That song played a big role in the band's early success, and it reflects Tom Maxwell's love for swing jazz and calypso rhythms that set the Zippers apart from the indie rock outfits of the 90s that were making Chapel Hill so famous at the time. And we talked about your love of Cab Calloway, mm-hmm. Fats Waller, that kind of music. And you wrote in an essay that unconsciously you had been writing that song most of your life. What
Hell.
Do you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, I had. Because we talked about like when I was a kid and mm-hmm. and there's this whole the whole sort of fundamentalist religious thing to which I suppose I was susceptible. I mean, at 6 years old, I wasn't going to say, oh, well, they're welcome there to their, you know, belief system, but it doesn't apply to me or whatever. I was like, holy crap. You know, this is terrible.
Right.
Yeah. And then I get to college and kind of everything just sort of blows wide open. You know, I enjoyed a number of chemical refreshments to which I had not been party, and then, you know, the love of a woman, that sort of thing. And mm-hmm. then I'm reading James Joyce and stuff. So, I really needed to kind of get that thing out.
Is it out or is there some hangover? In other words, I think the attraction, you can just simply reject a thing like that and say, oh, wait a minute, that's stupid, and move on. But when you recast it, when you work it over artistically, it could suggest some sense of wanting to get a more sophisticated, maybe a more nuanced handle on what had been handled better. Is it out of your system, or do you deal with
questions? No, it's totally a part of who I am. And not the whole eternal punishment for some mistake stuff. I think that's actually sort of psychotic. But the what you do in the dark will be brought to the light sort of thing, that's very resonant, you know, because the world is full of jerks, you know, and they get away with it, a lot of them. They do terrible things.
They run things.
They tend to run things. Yeah. And you're like, there's got to be – this doesn't occur. It's not a naturally occurring thing, this idea of justice or whatever, this idea of karma, of emotional sort of reciprocity or whatever. This doesn't come from nature. Things are eating each other. This is like a people thing. Right. And I want that. Yeah, yeah. You know, I need there to be some the books need to be balanced somehow. So part of that song – part of the song is about being hungover because you got drunk, you know, really. And then part of the song is sort of poking fun at the, you know, the hardcores. And then part of it is, you know what? Yeah, I kind of want this sort of. I want an aspect of this.
There's something. There's something to this. Let's investigate what. Now, what about the music? How did the band itself come about? And why, you know, how did this choice come about, this kind of very theatrical swing sound?
Well, you know, we were all bus boys and dishwashers and bartenders, and we were all in bands like everybody else that was in a band. And silly me, I had this idea that I had to get out of Chapel Hill because I don't know, it was somehow holding me back. And then I came to realize it was like the single greatest place that you could ever live. And so it's like the early 90s. You talked about the new Seattle thing. So we were all getting loaded at Tijuana Fats, you know, on Rosemary Street. And all of these, the greatest thing about town is that none of these bands sounded like each other. Nobody sounded like the Archers of Loaf. Nobody sounded like Metal Flake Mother. Nobody sounded like What Peggy Wants or the Pressure Boys. I could just list bands, all of whom, most of whom were friends of mine and really good guys. I forgot your question. Why did you start playing swing music? We focus grouped it, Frank. We focus grouped it. It's actually not very attractive. We like put people in a carpeted room and we ask them, you know, what they would. We did saturation research. I don't know that you really want to go into this. It's not very pretty.
You formed a band. Well, you were playing with a number of rock bands, as you say. You also discovered calypso music with artists like Lord Exeter. Lord Exeter. Lord Exeter was a famous Buffalo band.
Yes, and they sold nothing.
Exactly. Lord Executor.
Hideous discoveries and monstrous crime always happen at the Christmas time. Hideous discoveries and monstrous crime always happen at the Christmas time. For the old year, murders and atrocity. For the new year, serious calamity. What shocked Trinidad.
Now, did you in any way want to be like him?
Yes, my God, that makes me giddy.
Okay.
Okay, the lyric is hideous discoveries and monstrous crime always happen at the Christmas time. Do you want anything more out of music? Do you want? What? Okay, yeah, Executor. So this is what, late 30s, 1937, 1938, Trinidad. He was a white man.
Yeah.
Which is weird. And then he did Calypso, which is the music that they played during Carnival, and only during Carnival. And then Decca would sign these guys and they'd bring them up to New York and record. And when I heard that, I was like, what the hell is, what is happening? There's no drums. It's jazz instruments, but it's not jazz. It's super rhythmic. My parents had Harry Belafonte records, and that was supposed to be Calypso. That was Calypso. Yeah. And he's great, but this is a very, very different, very, very different thing.
So you're creating that, but the sound, and you've also said that the sound of jazz, that swing jazz, was a kind of pure expression of joy.
Yeah, it can be, sure, absolutely. Yeah. And menace. And so I think I think our greatest contribution to the world is music, as a culture, 20th century America's greatest contribution is art. Okay, we can say movies, but I think music, and it's jazz, and it changed everything. And then the architect basically was Louis Armstrong, and Louis Armstrong did the most difficult thing for a musician to do, which was just be the embodiment of joy.
Yeah.
Nirvana took the easy road. Do you know what I mean? They're a great band, but like the easy road is, dang it. Poor me, you know, pity party of one stuff.
Right.
And it's tough to be, and that has resonance, and it's good, it's great stuff. But like Armstrong, you know, he changed the face of the world.
Yeah, but he did at a particular time, in a particular place, within a context. I mean,
here's the thing though, Frank, that stuff got actually imprinted into our DNA. And you can go, I guess he was popular in the 1940s or whatever. And he was. Yeah. And then he died. So, you know, but like, no, he's actually still around. He's actually still around. We're actually carrying him. And I saw this firsthand because the Zippers didn't invent anything. We were odd and interesting. We were a good little band, and we had way more enthusiasm than Chops. And we put on a really good show. Did we invent any of this stuff? Did we invent Calypso? No. Did we invent whatever swing or Harlem hot music or blues or jug band or any klezmer, any of the stuff that we listened to and incorporated? No, of course not. We labored in an ancient vineyard. And when we went out and played that stuff to jaded Gen Xers in black stretch jeans in 1994, they flipped out. And so did their parents. Why? Because it's already inside of us.
That's true. But, I mean, the form does have to change. I mean, the Zippers are not in that form still with us today in the same way. Probably don't have the same impact they did even when they tour. So the fact is, if you're going to have that kind of impact, you really have to be speaking to a generation in its time because of its context, don't you? I mean, you can't – I understand carrying
forward. If you want to sell a lot
DNA,
of records, yes. But influence, it's like when you – and you don't know what your influence is going to be, and you can't know, and you better not spend any time thinking about it. But plenty of artists have dropped the stone in that water, and the ripples continue. You know, and it's very difficult for me to put myself to talk about the Squirrel Nut Zippers and Louis Armstrong in the same conversation is almost a kind of a tangential sort of exercise to me, because I think he's the greatest of all time.
What do you think accounted for that, first of all, the search, and then that observation, you know, that Chapel Hill was going to be the next Seattle? What was going on in Chapel Hill at that time to give it
much better stuff than what they wanted it to become? And we knew about Seattle, and we knew about Mudhoney and Nirvana and, Sub Pop bands and Pearl Jam and that sort of stuff. And they definitely had their own thing going on, and we liked it to the extent that we paid much attention. It had nothing to do with what was going on in Chapel Hill, I don't think, musically. Chapel Hill I loved because of its diversity of the bands that were there. And then when the whole new Seattle thing happened, one, what is lamer than saying you're the new anything? Just new Coke, remember?
Right.
Okay.
But I mean, the theory is that you're not that you're the next thing. So yeah, clearly you're different. Clearly you are. You don't sound the same. But there was some hunger for something new, and Chapel Hill seemed to have it.
There was some hunger. There was some hunger that the Bean Counters and the Culture Mavens could apply their paradigm and make a predictive model. Okay, and say, okay, we're going to make money over here now. And then to a certain extent, it was just sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, these guys that are writing for Spin Magazine and stuff, and these program directors at these Clear Channel stations, they want to tell you what you like, and they want to tell you what you want to hear, and they do not like it when somebody comes out of left field. But of all the fantastic bands that were in Chapel Hill in, say, 1994, the two that made it out nationally were as far from any kind of grunge affiliation as could be conceived, which would be the Squirrel Nut Zippers and Ben Folds Five. And so, you know, what they tried to do didn't work, but it changed. Things changed. There was all this scrutiny. Bands broke up. Some people advanced and other people receded. You know, there were bidding wars, big label bidding wars over some bands, and sort of that stuff sort of happened, but it didn't shake out the way they thought it would.
What about the critical reception for Squirrel Nut Zippers? At first, the critics didn't know quite what to make of you.
No, at first it was like underground genius iconoclasts are taking a bold step, and these are fantastic. And then as soon as we had a hit, we put out this album and that we recorded when we were broke little punks touring in a van, and then the song takes off. It's still the same album. The album is like 8 months old, and then all of a sudden it's our new album. And the critics are saying, you know, transparent sellouts tap into latest fad. I'm like, it's the same record. Can't you wait?
Right. For our next record, which is going to be even bigger. Even bigger. You talked about making that. It was when you were making Hot, wasn't it, that you saw a ghost?
Yeah, Ken Mosher saw a ghost. Yeah. There's a haunted. It was an unambiguously haunted studio. I don't really care what anybody thinks. I mean, normally I don't usually care what people think, but this time I'm particularly adamant that this place was haunted, and it was on the corner of Charter and Esplanade and the French Quarter. It was a mansion. And the ghost showed up all the time. And not just to us, to other people. People would leave because they saw or they had some experience, and they would just take off. Yeah. And they would bail on their sessions and stuff. And so a song was erased, and there was a rack. There was like loud noises and banging and faces appearing in windows and things like that. Yeah. It was wide open, actually.
But you don't think that was a setup? I mean, they must have loved taking, you know, you can imagine if I owned that house, how I might want to just stage a lot of fun for the band.
When we pulled up to the house and the studio manager came out to greet us, I said, what's the name of your spook? Because it seemed so obvious to me. Yeah. And she looked stricken. It was bad for business. She did not want to talk about it. Yeah.
No. Well, and you went back there. And
I went back there as often as I could.
Right?
Yeah,
but you're,
yeah.
you're a solo.
I went back there, and then the piano player, a lot of stuff happened again, but the piano player came out and said, the trombone player came out and said, I don't like this house. I just saw a woman sitting in a chair on the balcony, and I said, well, who's busting into the session because we don't want him to make noise during this take? And he goes, no, she was transparent. And then the piano player was like, oh, yeah, I saw her when I first came. And then the sousaphone player, who's Julius McKee from the Dirty Dozen, would not even go upstairs.
Wow.
My wife at the time had to go sit next to him during the take because he was, I'm not going to play. I'm not going to do this. And I said, actually, would you please?
It would sound
because I want to make
better.
A record. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of important that you're on this record. So, but you went back. Did you go back deliberately? And why did you go back to
magic.
That studio?
It's magic.
Yeah.
It was magic. And it was beautiful. And it had great gear. And it was New Orleans. And so if you want to drink deeply, you go to the well.
Yeah. We should play a sample from that, Samsara. This was one of two solo projects that you released. This one in 2003. Let's listen.
A sad, sad song. We all must sing along. If our fondest wish comes true, we only wish for something new. But thank you for everything beautiful. For everything, thank you. I love you so, I love you so, I love you so, I love you so.
That's Holly Badur doing the vocals on Samsara, released by Tom Maxwell, my guest this hour, that released in 2003. Let's talk about the transition from Squirrel Nut Zippers to solo career.
Well, there was the goodbye right there. That song was the goodbye. I mean, there was a lot of like, I'm angry and I'm sad and all that other stuff. But actually, that was I'm not sure that I was aware of it at the time, but it was really just, I have to go now and thank you, you know. There's an aspect of me which is, or us or person that can acknowledge all of the disappointment and rage and ego and sadness and despair and then just say, you know, thank you. It was really cool. And Holly, I have to say again, what a voice. Holy crap.
You just can't say that enough.
She's
can
amazing. Yeah. She's an amazing person, but golly. Yeah.
Well, do you think you had to write that? Is that something you really couldn't have gone on without making the farewell, without acknowledging musically, artistically that you've made a transition?
Yeah, I had to do that. And it wasn't done out of obligation. It wasn't a thing where I was like, the next country I'm going to invade on the risk board is the heartfelt goodbye song. It was like, no. And I wanted to do, Frank, I grew up listening to the Beatles. And the Beatles infected me in a number of ways, most of them good. But the Beatles said, hey, man, you don't have to do one kind of music. Mm. You can do all kinds of different genres or whatever, or make up your own, as long as it serves the sort of emotional heart of the song. I don't know where
what's,
I was going
what's
with
the
that.
Takeaway?
Oh, so and also they said you can do a concept album, which led to a lot of terrible, terrible artistic efforts by people. But that record is essentially about this Buddhist concept of samsara, which is the opposite of Nirvana. It's the it's funny, isn't it? The opposite of Nirvana. That's funny. No wonder Sub Pop wouldn't sign me. And with this, like, the endless cycle of desire and dissatisfaction. So, you know, you want what you can't have, and then when you get it, you don't want it anymore, and you're just on this hamster wheel forever.
Yeah. Did you have to think long and hard? I mean, what was the takeaway from the Squirrel Nut Zippers experience? Was it, were you a long time recovering from that, or was it easy?
Well, yeah, like up until February.
Wow. Of this year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm telling you, it's like
you left in 99, just for the
record. I left in 99, and it happened, in a very sort of, it happened very quickly, you know, and we went from selling 20,000 copies of the records that we had just made and felt pretty good and were making the new record to being informed that we had a hit and saying, literally saying, what does that mean? Because we didn't know what it meant. Everybody else knew what it meant. And then, and I don't know, by the next year, selling 30,000 copies a week, which is, you're not able to wrap your head around. And you say, this is all a dream. Mm. This will pass away. I can't mistake this for anything real. And then when it does end, it's still completely messed with your head.
My guest, Tom Maxwell, musician, writer, one of the founders of Squirrel Nut Zippers, and our conversation will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest, Tom Maxwell, songwriter, musician, father. Tom's going to be a featured storyteller as well at the Monty season finale Tuesday, May 22nd at the Arts Center in Carrboro. The theme is do-overs, which I guess, you know, is a theme for a guy who led a pop, you know, star life and now is leading a creative life in other ways.
Sure, what the hell? I mean, yeah, do-overs, why not? I'll figure something out.
You'll figure something out. Let's talk a little bit about fatherhood. Two kids.
Yeah.
Evelyn is 12, Esten is 9. And was it a challenge to navigate fatherhood as a musician?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, I said yes because I stopped saying no. And also, I just figured that I was a guy that was going to be a dad. I figured that I was going to have kids, you know, because, you know, my parents did or whatever. And then, wow, you know, and then Evelyn came into the world and this door opened and I walked through it and I was transformed and, like, you know, I smiled so much that my face looks different now because but I also made an assumption. I'm really good, Frank, at I'm going to start a business on the side, which is how to make difficult situations worse. And I think that, like, if I could make a killing, except people seem to be endlessly inventive at doing that. So they don't, and it's not really, there's not a niche for me. So I'll just stick with my own, you know, big effing problem. But so I thought, oh, well, you can't be a musician and be a dad. And I stopped touring and all this, you know, the whole let's put childish things away stuff, you know, which ended up, again, just messing with my head really unnecessarily, I think. I don't really feel that way anymore.
It seems to me the thing people, what they imagine is going to happen to their careers when they have children is it's going to get in the way. There's now a new demand on my time.
Yes.
But in a way, I'd like to know what you think about this idea that it's a different form of create. To be a parent, to be a husband, to be a spouse is a creative enterprise. You wake up every day and you have to sort of reinvent your relationship. You have to, the kids are working their way around you by the second. They're smarter than you. They're faster than you and sort of getting their way. So it's probably the most, can be an extremely creative enterprise, but a different kind of creativity. It's not that it's taking up your time. It's that it's accessing a different form of creativity, pulling you from that. How about that?
I think I'm subscribing to your newsletter, Frank Stacio's Parenting Weekly, because you're exactly right. Yeah. And then also it makes you walk the walk. You know, you can go around spouting platitudes and be just as sort of dissonant as is possible in terms of like what you think things, how you think you should be and how you actually act, you know, and then the kids are looking at you and you're like, why are you smoking a cigarette behind a tree? And because I can do, because I, it's complicated, you know, okay? That's why.
Right. And quite a challenge. Esten, when he was 3, diagnosed with leukemia, and that, of course, was a challenging time for you.
Yeah, I think that's it. Challenging.
Yeah.
I lost my mind.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to – and so I actually was – it was very easy, okay, because when the worst possible thing happens, if it was me – then I could have like crawled up into the attic and been like had a little drama about it. But when it's your 3-year-old son, for crying out loud, you're just like, okay, I know what I need to do. It's very difficult, but it's not hard.
What?
Just to going up on the pediatric oncology ward, pushing chemo into his port and telling him that it's going to make him feel better, or wiping him when he's covered in diarrhea or vomiting or looking at the way, you know, watching his hair fall out. All of the things that happen, or seeing children die who are diagnosed at the same time, and you just feel like you're just running like hell, like you are, you'd better just keep running because it's a minefield and you just don't want to get blown up, but you can't stop. And so I put a lot of stuff on the emotional credit card. Can't deal now, deal later, you know, and then it all came due later. But
well, what happened then?
I fell apart after he was done. So his,
we should say he's fine.
He's
now.
Great.
Yeah.
He stopped treatment 2 years ago. He had, okay. So, you know,
he's
you're
nine.
He's nine. You're up on the pediatric oncology ward and you're talking to one of the nurses and she says, I never thought I'd say this. I never thought I would say this, but you know, I tell parents like you that your son has the good cancer. Hmm. And I thought the good cancer, good Lord. But then when you're in the trench, you're like, oh, actually you're right. Cause when I was five, lights out, 5% survivable, no way, you know, when I was his age. Now it's 93-95% survivable. The odds of it coming back are vanishingly small. This is the acute lymphocytic leukemia stuff. The other stuff, the myelogic stuff where you have to get bone marrow transplants, 50-50.
Yeah.
50-50.
I want to talk to you some more about this idea, though, of putting it on the emotional credit card, as you said, and sort of how the artist copes with this. Because it seems to me one of the projects of the artist is to get at what they're feeling now, to get that feeling today. It doesn't have to be, but one of the projects can be instant access to what's behind this, right? And yet we as humans are infamously famous for being able to put it off, and of course that's the source of our sorrow, not even being able to articulate it. Is that a whole different way? Because as an artist, I mean, first of all, is my assumption right? I mean, is that what you're trying to access? Get to me, get to what's behind it in the moment? Maybe not.
My job is to take the specific and make it universal. And I do that with varying degrees of success. And if I think about it for a second, then I'm screwed. Mm-hmm. If I think, gosh, I hope Frank likes this song, then I'm not even writing the song. I'm engaging in some kind of exercise. But when stuff got hard, mm-hmm. I have a number of phrases about it, none of which I can repeat on the air. They're very descriptive, though. I just stopped writing, and I stopped listening to music. And so music had always been my pal and my ally and my confidant and my muse and the light fingers of my lover on my back in the morning. And then like when that stuff was going down, I pushed it away I just couldn't, you know, and I did a little bit, but I'm still kind of coming out of that state of almost being inarticulate, not just because it's not about, it's not an artistic exercise. It's not about how we're feeling. It's about what his numbers are when they do a blood panel. It's about what the numbers are in the thermometer when they take his temperature, because you're going to need to know whether or not he has to be hospitalized. It all becomes quantitative. It all has to be measured, and how much you're paying in health insurance and all that stuff.
Your second project, though, came out did it deal with the perseverance?
There's a lot of that on there. Yeah.
And you had to deal with that consciously and artistically. You've had to think about what all of this in terms of how it could come out as music.
Maybe in terms of sequencing the record, and you say, well, if I want this to be a kind of a narrative arc, then I should put it in some sort of order. Yeah. But in terms of like, I really need to write a 6-8 ballad about being on the pediatric oncology ward. No, yeah. I did, but I certainly wasn't thinking about it. Like, here's another piece of the puzzle that it's more just like, oh, God, this has got to come out.
And then what changed for you? How did you regain access? How were you able to articulate, listen again, create again?
Well, I never wanted to die, but at some point I did not want to keep living. And, you know, when it was very tough, I would go up on the ward. And, you know, if you turned, if you went in one direction from the elevators, you'd go through these big wooden doors once they saw your ID, and then you'd be inside the pediatric oncology ward. On the other side were these windows, and I would stand there and fight this urge to just jump right out. And it wasn't because I had a job to do. It wasn't like I didn't want an out. I just wanted a break. And then, you know, 2010, and my son is done and he's great. And then all of a sudden I'm having debilitating panic attacks and stuff. I'm afraid to go check the mail. It's funny. Wow. I was almost like trying to assume like some sort of comma shape on the floor. Just I was smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee and just panicking. And that person probably actually did just die. He's like a little sort of Tom-shaped lump of ash. Wow. Now, because he just couldn't persist. And then I rose up and was like, well, let's just get on with it, shall we? You know?
Did you rise up or did somebody new rise up out of that?
Well, I think that once I stopped having real problems, then I was free to go into my full-blown midlife crisis, which isn't the I'm going to get a big-boobed trophy wife. Can I say that? Because I just did.
You just did.
Okay.
And now we know precisely what you're looking
for. I owe Susie money for the FCC violation. Okay, that's cool. I'll write a check. And a sports car. What I want to do, Frank, is climb all the way on the inside, get rid of all the detritus, make sure that my external life is a reflection of my internal life, get rid of all the dissonance, and just wake up to my true self.
No problem.
It's great.
In fact, we got about 7 minutes left. You could do that now.
7 minutes. Well, where should I begin?
Well, let's
talk about the story of how great a love can be.
Last year, you did Kingdom Come, another solo project, and we talked about this whole issue of perseverance. I want to listen to a little bit from that CD, Why I Smoke.
Tom Maxwell, Why I Smoke, from his latest project, Kingdom Come. My guest this hour on The State of Things. That sounds like, because you just quit smoking a few weeks
ago. I did.
I
quit smoking almost 2 months ago, yeah.
So there you go. You named the thing. You created that. You named it, right? And you worked through it in that song. And now you're done.
So you approve?
Yeah.
Cool.
No, it's good.
One thing that I should mention, though, is the great, great guitar playing on that track is Snooze. who has been on this show, Britt Harper, Uzzell, amazing guy. Lots to say about him, but he's dying of lymphoma, and he can't afford health insurance. And the last I spoke to him, he told me that he was quitting his, and I hope he doesn't mind me telling the story, but he told me that he was quitting his cover band, even though they were making pretty good money. And I said, why? And he said, because I can't afford treatment, the hospital won't treat me anymore, and I'm going to go out playing my own music.
Wow.
So, you know, that's what I want to talk about. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's the stuff that makes me want to, like, rip my hair out.
I mean, the fact that people can be running around in this country with no health insurance.
The fact that we just cast them off like that, and then this is they're supposed to do what exactly? This is who we are. This is who we are. This is not who we are. I mean, UNC was not going to turn my son away, Esten, even if we didn't have health insurance, which I did, and so all is well. Even though the premiums, whatever the whatever deductibles almost killed me, they weren't going to turn them away. But boy, there are places that will. They'll just say no.
Well, you have to. Yeah, I mean, you have to make some accommodation and make a choice about whether you're going to live a little longer or something different.
I thought What's News told me was probably the most mature thing I'd ever heard anybody say.
Yeah. So when you write and you have come through, I mean, you're talking about your own emotional, what did you call it? Your emotional credit card. You think you've paid? Have you paid most of that down now?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I mean, I guess a lot came due, and then you know you have to figure out sort of how to carry forward, and one strategy would be to run away or to acquire or accrue, and another strategy would be to go like, okay, well, let's just sit down and take a look at who we are, and sort of clear up some clutter and be a little bit more efficient. And that's me. That's what I'm doing. I feel good about it. You said something. You said, what did you say? You said, the only reason I put my shoes on in the morning. Did you?
The project is to get to the root of all of this behavior and find out what's really behind it and what's really driving it. I mean, otherwise, really, it's not. You know, this show wouldn't be interesting enough to do for me to wake up every day if there wasn't a deeper project. But I don't know if you feel that way, because it seems to me your music and your whole trajectory seem to point toward that same kind of interest.
Absolutely, and you can always count on me to do things the hard way.
You lead with your head, do you?
Yeah. Right into the wall.
Tom, what a pleasure talking with you.
Always, Frank. Thank you so much for having me.
Tom Maxwell, songwriter, essayist, and a father, lives in Pittsburgh, North Carolina. For more information on his writing and music, go to tommaxwell.com. Going to be the featured storyteller at the season finale of The Monty, Tuesday, May 22nd, the Arts Center in Carrboro. That's at 7 o'clock. And for more on that, visit themonty.org. For show information, we're going to be live at Greensboro this Friday, a broadcast from Triad Stage. Going to be an update on the latest news. We're going to look at the Edwards trial, and we've got some music for you as well. It's going to be live music at the Upstage Cabaret Triad Stage in Greensboro. We'd love for you to join us. You can be in the audience this Friday in Greensboro. Just send an email to rsvp@wunc.org. Let our staff know you want to be there Friday, May 18th at noon, for a live broadcast of the State of Things. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.